My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest has spent most of his adult life finding and destroying landmines. We talk about his military operations in Bosnia and Iraq, as well as the extensive work he's carried out for the Halo Trust in Asia and Africa. He now spends his time planning and implementing world record endurance events, a Royal Engineer, a Commando, a Brand Ambassador, an Ocean Rower, a Team HESCO Special, Charlie Martel. This is Declassified. Born 1970 in Gloucestershire.
Yep.
What was childhood like?
Interesting. My father was the son of an admiral in the Royal Navy. HMS Belfast was one of his flagships. What was his flagship? Served in the Second World War. So had a awesome grandfather to look up to. We didn't see him very much. His wife was absolutely brilliant. And when she died, it was a big loss some years later. So childhood was interesting. My father and my mother, to be fair, sent me away to two very good schools, and I didn't really give them a very good return on their investment because I didn't do very well in my exams. But I thoroughly enjoyed my school life, my childhood. Divorce is messy, and I think it probably always is messy, but that had an impact through the sort of O-level year.
What, your mum and dad?
Yeah. Which meant I didn't sort of focus too much on my education at that point. I was very focused on joining the military from 1982 when I saw the Falklands War on TV. And I always knew I'd wear a uniform. I always knew I'd wear a green beret. I didn't know I'd be in the Royal Engineers as a commando. I didn't know if I was going to be a Royal Marines officer. I always wanted to be a Royal Marine officer. Yeah. So long and short of it is, you know, some years later, yes, I made it to Royal Engineers. Yes, I got my commando beret, and I did make it to be an officer.
I mean, but, we're not there yet. Yeah. Bloody hell, you've just ruined the first 25 minutes of this.
Childhood was good.
But that was the reason then, was it? Because you joined the Royal Engineers in 1988.
Yeah.
And it was because of the Falklands War, seeing that on TV and whatnot.
I think so. My dad's a farmer, he makes cheese. I never really wanted to be a farmer and make cheese myself at that stage. I was way too young and was more interested in doing adventurous stuff. I always used to disappear on my bicycle to the point where my father used to drive around the villages and try and find me because he didn't know where I was.
Yeah.
I just decided to, you know, disappear. So, climbing trees, all the usual sort of boy stuff as kids used to do. Seeing the Falklands War on TV and having friends, dads who were serving out there, I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to wear a uniform. I want to carry a big machine gun, carry a big rucksack. And that's why I joined the army. And in fact, the day I joined or went through to the Army Careers Interview Office in Cheltenham, I was walking past and I thought, I can have a look. End up signing up. Didn't realise I was in the wrong office.
How old was you when you signed?
17 and a half.
Yeah.
I took some papers home for my dad and he said, I'm not signing those. So I just waited until I was old enough, which was, you know, just a few months and joined up.
When you first joined, this is something I was thinking about on the way here. Did you ever get homesick when you left?
But no, I was at boarding school from the age of 7 or 8. For me, it was an escape. It was my parents still going through a difficult divorce, nasty times. For me, it was perfect. Get away to do something I wanted to do. So it was a perfect escape for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. You joined, again, the Royal Engineers. We've already talked about it anyway. You did your All Arms Commando course. Initially, it was going to go to 5-9 Commandos, or Independent Commando Squadron.
Yeah.
But you, for one thing or another, you ended up in EOD. So what is EOD?
EOD is Explosive Ordnance Disposal. And at that time, there was only one regiment in the Royal Engineers doing that, which was 3-3 Engineer Regiment, Explosive Ordnance Disposal. And at the time, there was three squadrons. There was 4-9 Squadron, 2-2 Squadron, and 5-8 Squadron. 5-8 at the time was pretty much busy with Home Office search, defence search, like the defend against the Brighton bomb style bombing again.
Oh, right, okay.
So Bournemouth, Blackpool, all the sort of conference centres, that was their main role. 4-9 was Adver Operations, and we had an airborne troop, a commando troop, and at the time, Allied Command Europe mobile force troop. So airborne went off and did their airborne stuff. Commando went off, worked for 3 Commando Brigade, and 3 Troop went off to work for Allied Command Europe.
So you'd be there to back up, like the Parachute Regiment and the Royal Marines, is that?
Slightly, yeah. So what happens is you've got your Royal Marines who are supported by many different cap badges, from engineers, RLC, artillery, in a commando element. So you've done all your basic training, your trade training as a combat engineer, and in my case, EOD training. Then you volunteer for commando forces as well, and you go and support the commando brigade as an EOD asset. Mm. So for us, we had an entire troop commando trained. So whenever the three commando brigade went on exercise or operations, an element of us would go with them, most likely with 5-9 commando squadron as a sort of an extra troop, but sometimes with brigade HQ. So we became an asset to the brigade. That was one role. We had a couple of other roles, which I'm probably not allowed to talk about, but let's just say it was lots of fun and working with special forces. Yeah, it was great fun.
They're really within the engineers. I mean, I spent my time playing rugby, but you know, the commando squadrons are always really well looked up to, yeah. Especially when you go on courses with them. They're always the kind of higher achievers. They want to push for everything, and it's a really I suppose an environment where people can thrive, especially if they're into the soldiering and, yeah. and getting down. And it's not always about guys with, you know, the infantry role. There's all these other roles as well in the British, especially in the British Army,
yeah.
Which are much needed. And this is one of them, so specific and so crucial. Which you know, this is 1989 now. Mm. You know, that's a young soldier. Gulf War kicks off. Gulf War One kicks off in 91. You deploy. What was the feeling around? I don't think we've touched on Gulf War One yet. So
yeah, I think there's a lot of excitement. I think by the younger troops doing something you train for, even if it was a short period of time as a youngster. It was like, we can't believe we're getting our chance to go on operations at such a young age. You know, yeah. The last war was 1982, 7 years before, or 8-9 years before. So to deploy on operations in a high risk role, in terms of high risk of going to war, was interesting. However, I'm not going to sit here and lie to you and say I was one of the first guys in the first troop of the first squadron to go out. 4-9 squadron went and deployed. There was a few of us left as BCRs, battle casualty replacements, and I was one of them.
All right.
So out of each troop, there'd be a number left back, and there's only about 2-3 per troop. So I was held back in the UK until January 1991. So basically looking after rear party and doing sort of rubbish jobs, that sort of stuff. The reality was, early January, we were deployed, and then literally a couple of days later, the war kicked off. So we weren't then battle the casualty replacements; we were augmentees or, you know, extra pair of hands. Okay. So from being in the UK while everyone else is on overseas in the desert, having Christmas at home, then deploying, there's a lot of jealousy from the troops.
Yeah.
How come you're here? You've just arrived and get some time in. And I've just arrived for the start of the war. I think there's a lot of excitement for the guys in the sand who are waiting. I think they were pretty annoyed that they were waiting for so long, and then obviously we were.
How long
up.
Were they waiting for? The
months, 4 or 5 months, roughly.
Really? Was it that long?
Yeah. It was maybe 3 months, 3 or 4 months, maybe.
But it was a period of time. It wasn't a couple of weeks.
No. It was months. Yeah, a substantial amount of time there.
Because when we deployed to Antalik, the Second Gulf War, we weren't there long before it started.
No, that's right. So 1990, during the invasion of Kuwait. The troops were pretty much sat in Saudi in the desert just waiting for the green light. The war wasn't really kicking off until early January, and it was an air war that began and then followed up by the ground war. So the build-up to it, I think there's a lot of excitement, like I say, for the younger troops. The older troops, officers would have probably thought, crumbs, we're going to war here. This is pretty serious. I remember our OC at the time was not in a happy place at all. It was 101 or so troops deployed, and himself leading it, he wasn't a happy chap. And I don't know the ins and outs, but maybe there was issues at home, but he wasn't too happy. The interesting thing for me for Gulf War One was some of my troop were called forward by special forces to go and do an operation into Kuwait City. And for them, that was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So they basically abseiled in into the embassy, and there's photos across the sun of this guy abseiling down from a Sea King, who I think I know who it is, but I'm not sure. But yeah, for a young bloke, it's cracking, great fun.
Yeah.
The war then, it was all over quite quickly, and we started then doing explosive ordnance disposal out there, and my troop.
It's just you're blowing stuff up.
Yes. We're not
but controlled.
Absolutely controlled. Yeah. So we're moving a lot of safe to move ammunition, so mortars which aren't fused, for example, which are safe to move, moving them to an ammunition dump for further disposal. And we were then sent to a place called Doha Power Station on the beach there. And we were clearing up some of the beach of some of the shell scrapes, the bunkers, the defensive positions from the Iraqi army were there. We were clearing them out of basically all the ordnance that we could find on the beach. What we didn't know initially was there was anti-personnel mines there. Unfortunately, one of the guys sustained an injury when he caused a small anti-personnel mine to function.
A Royal Engineer?
A Royal Engineer, yeah, from Commando, from my troop. And damaged his eye and left him with, a lump of metal in the base of his brain, which can't be removed. So he was.
Is he still alive?
Still alive, yeah. He's Kazavat, back to UK, and he's still alive, lives up in sort of Lancashire Way. Yeah.
Blimey. The vile things, especially anti-personnel mines. We'll get onto it in a second, a bit more about that. But with regards to kind of like blowing stuff up, what scale was it at?
What was it like? I'm just trying to think back. I don't think we were doing much demolitions at the time. I think we were just literally filling the back of a tipper truck with mortars and bombs, which were safe to move back to a demolition point. I don't recall, off the top of my head, doing any demolitions actually at the end of the First Gulf War.
Okay.
The biggest issue we had at the time, which obviously there's repercussions now, is all the drugs we were taking, naps, bats, and any other thing. The anti-chemical agent drugs, which personally I don't think have had an effect on me, but we were taking them religiously. Demolitions, I can't recall doing anything in anger at that stage. I think we were just
not to dwell on this because this isn't necessarily your story, but there's so many similarities between like the Gulf War One or the engineer role in brackets and then Gulf War Two, because how we were doing some same stuff.
Yeah,
we were getting mortars and we were getting rockets, piling them into big ditches, and then blowing them up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Tanks, blowing them up. That's what we're just doing. Yeah. So it's not always a commando or an EOD role. It's actually a Royal Engineer role, you go into it in a much more specific way. Mm. So we moved then. By the way, your story is movement continuously. So bear with me here. We then moved to southern Turkey, northern Iraq.
Yes. Yeah.
Same year.
Same year. It was basically went home on leave and expecting a nice big 6 weeks break. And about 2 weeks after being at home, I got a phone call. I was actually at my friend's house in Devon. And the phone rang and said, we're deploying next week. Do you want to go? And I'm like, yeah, of course. Southern Turkey, Northern Iraq, Operation Safe Haven. A commando brigade deployment. And we literally packed up the trucks, drove to Bryce Norton, drove onto an aircraft and flew out to southern Turkey. I forget which one it was. It was either Incirlik or Diyarbakir. I think it was Incirlik. And then a period of time later, we met up at the 5-9. We drove across the border into northern Iraq and took up a position in a place called Sarsenk. And we were there for a couple of months.
What did you do?
EOD again. So we were this time collecting and destroying a lot of ammunition. When I'm talking ammunition, I'm talking about projectiles, 122mm weapons, basically. Yeah. Sort of projectiles fired from tanks or artillery pieces. Including anti-personnel mines, including rifle grenades. There's only 10 of us. We split into day shift, night shift.
Were you searching, or was you just collecting?
No, just collecting. Yeah, there was no ID threat there or any of that sort of stuff.
No mine?
No, not laid at the time, no. Just bulk stores, basically.
Oh, so it was hard graft then? You were shifting a lot?
Yeah. We've even got photos at home now of where it was a whole line of projectiles all lined up and a charge on each one to destroy. It was a 4-tonner a day. Not full, but near as damn it full of ammunition.
Yeah.
For half a troop and half a troop. And half a troop for us was 4 or 5 people. It's hard graft. Busy, busy.
And was that, assuming though, was that the remnants of the Gulf War there?
Yes, basically it would have been the Republican Guard who ran away and left Kurdistan for whatever reason.
Okay, that's right.
So we were there to sort of support the Kurds and in a sort of humanitarian role, in effect. The Overseas Development Agency, which became DFID, the Department for International Development, were there doing their humanitarian stuff. Engineers were busy doing construction, repairing all sorts of stuff. And I'm talking, 5-9 there, the troops all over the place.
Yeah.
Recce troop working with the commando.
What kind of, just talk about construction, because we've not really delved into the engineer task. So.
Yeah, I'm not sure the entire construction that went on, because we were split to the four winds. The EOD team were based at headquarters, commando brigade headquarters, and deployed from there. But the troops from 5-9 were split up. Recce troop was in one place doing semi-sneaky stuff, I guess, and support troop were doing their plant machinery stuff. So they had combat engineer tractor graders, putting roads back into use, perhaps. There's all sorts of stuff going on, which even now I'm not sure what they were
doing. So we could be, you know, we're talking things like water points. Potentially runway if it was needed.
Water point was actually one of the critical ones, primarily for the brigade. We had to go every day to go and get water, fill up the trailer, jerry cans, fill it up. And they did a cracking job of keeping that water constantly flowing. Water off the mountains. Really good job on the water point on that one.
It is, and I said before, I'm glad you're here, because it's so, the engineer roles are so diverse.
Absolutely.
From drilling wells to diving, which we'll get on to, EOD and all the rest of it.
Diverse is exactly the word. There's my biggest regret with being a human in this age, there is so much going on in the engineers, there's not enough time for any human to do it all. And that's my biggest regret.
You tried though, which we'll get on to. And then what was the feeling like then in southern Turkey or Kurdistan? Like, what was the feeling like? I know he was there for a couple of months, but was it quick exit or was it protracted?
Yeah, the Kurds, I think, enjoyed us being there. And I'm not talking about the militia, but the people who were internally displaced. Refugee camps, I can't call them refugees because they're internally displaced, but IDP camps. So the locals, I think, liked us being there because we're bringing some good. We're clearing up ammunition from our point of view, clearing up a big mess. But for me, I was a bit of a loss, and I think I still haven't sort of looked into it in the past, but we seemed to pack up and disappear almost overnight. The brigade literally packed up and left almost overnight, and I think we left the Americans there. Now, there's clearly a political decision behind that, but as a young sapper on the ground, to me, it's a bit strange that we were doing so much good and suddenly, bang, we're off, and it was game over. Come home, tin medals, you know, happy days. But it was just, even now, I've got a soft spot for Kurdistan, and we'll come on to that a bit later. But it's an interesting place. It's a very, very, very pretty place as well. It's a beautiful part of the country. But it was just bizarre how he left so quickly. But like I say, political decisions were made clearly.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing some good stuff there, and you came back to the UK, and then it was Norway, bit of Northern Ireland, Norway.
Yeah. Diving course. Julian chose Carter.
Stop showing off. And he was really packed in, and I've jumped as maybe 5 years to Bosnia in 1996.
Yeah, 96. Yes, 96 was busy. It was Norway first, then come back from that after a couple of months and straight out to Bosnia. Again, a commando troop deployment. We split up into small teams. If my memory serves me, it was a troop commander and basically three of us, two junior NCOs and a sapper, two vehicles, pretty much in simple terms, driving around the countryside, picking up ordnance and destroying it. So we'd get a lot of calls. Some of them were emergency calls out somewhere, standard taskings where there was no rush, you could go out the next day and deploy. So two-thirds of the troop were based in Gorni Vakuf, GV in the headquarters there, and then the other third would be based up country in a place called Cluj, and we were co-located with the
what
Canadians.
Was the current, so take this as I say, we don't need a history lesson. What was the kind of current situation there, because you know we're 4 years after the conflict started. What was it like there?
It was still unsettled, but it was peaceful, and I say peaceful, there was still insurgents from both sides, from I forget the exact names, but from the Muslim side and the non-Muslim side. I'm going to get shot down here, but we had a Muslim interpreter, a female Muslim interpreter. We went to speak to the side. They would not talk to her.
Right.
A, she was the wrong sex, and B, she was the wrong religion.
Okay.
So it was still very difficult. So we had to sort of try and find other interpreters.
And there was still risk, and especially with the kind of ordnance and the mines.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the biggest risk was ordnance and mines. The mines were well laid all over the place, sporadic possibly, but somebody knew where they were, and there were some maps. We didn't get all of those, but the local people generally knew where they were. The mine accident rate, I believe, in Bosnia at the time was fairly low for local people because they knew.
Is that because it was planned?
Either that or they probably spoke to people who said, don't go down there, for example, and they avoided those areas. They sort of stayed on main roads and that sort of stuff. So for us, we were busy picking up items on the side of the road which the locals may have moved and marked it, and on one occasion obviously there was an accident with green troops, British forces, testing a route up in the mountains, and they went bang. Two scimitars, which are the light recce vehicles,
like tanks,
tracked quite small, up a mountain track, and the first one, the splines, so the edges of the track must have touched an anti-tank mine, and it was a particularly good anti-tank mine. It's a, you know, it's in production, you know, Yugoslav made, and that spline touched the top of the anti-tank mine and caused the blast to go up the side of the tank. Luckily, no one was killed. When we were tasked with that, and obviously it was an emergency call out, we drove in from a different direction in our Land Rovers, stopped short of where we thought would be a decent place to stop. Then we started searching our way in with metal detectors. And on our way in, we found 10 anti-tank mines across the track, which we would have driven over, or the tanks would have driven over coming down.
Are they surface laid, or are they underground?
They're underground, yeah. There was ground sign, to be fair, but you could. We still had to search our way in. And then as you went up the track around the left-hand bend, we saw the two tanks there, the two scimitars, and searched our way around the damaged one, and there was another 4 anti-tank mines around it.
So. How were you searching?
Just metal detector. I believe it was only 4 of us, so one man in front and the 3 guys behind us, just, you know, side to side, metal detecting, searching pattern. Yeah. Ground sign was quite clear, I think, to be fair.
So when would that have been put in there?
Good question. Honestly, don't know. Could have been years, but it still would have shown the ground sign because the mounds you saw on the track. It wasn't a metalled road; it was a track, dirt track. But it looked out of place. You know, the rest of the track was smooth, and then you saw these bumps.
Okay. Right.
But around the tank, we probably wouldn't have found those by eyesight alone. They were well camouflaged. So we took those out, destroyed them on site, and made sure there's a safe route in for a recovery tank to come in and pick up the damaged scimitar and then get the guys out.
What's the difference? And obviously there's the name, right? Anti-tank, anti-personnel. Mm. What is the difference? What are we looking at?
Predominantly size. An anti-personnel mine, a typical small anti-personnel mine, because again, there's different sizes. A Chinese Type 72, for example, is probably the size of a mug in terms of diameter.
Yeah.
About the depth of probably a third of a mug. That will probably take your foot off. If you were to stand on an anti-tank mine with an initiation system which allows a human to stand on it and destroy it, because bear in mind a lot of these anti-tank mines take a lot more weight than a human.
Yeah.
That will kill you outright, no question about it.
Yeah.
So it's all about volume and net explosive quantity. How much explosive is in that mold,
casing,
if you like. Casing, that's just blast mines. There's different types of mines.
Oh, yeah, now it's been really general. Really general. There's all sorts of stuff, isn't there, that can leap up and hit you in the face and all sorts. Horrible. You cleared.
We've got the base. We cleared up the route and around the tank, got the guys out and cleared a route for the recovery vehicle to come in, which would have happened once we'd left.
Was it busy then in Bosnia? Because you were constantly working.
Yeah, there was. We did have R&R down in a place called Primiston, which was great fun. Just, you know, chill out, have a few beers and just go water skiing on the back of a Mark V assault boat. Yeah. So it's an engineer's boat with a rope out the back and a couple of skis, which is great, bit of canoeing. A few days there, then back up country again. So there was downtime, but it was busy, yeah. And it was cold. I think it was a summer tour, but I do remember snow on the ground or mud on the ground. Yeah. So it wasn't...
My brother will correct me because he'll listen to this. But he was around the same time. It was either the winter before or the winter after. And he was in the engineers, and he was clearing all the snow from the roads.
Yeah.
My brother's name's Gary, and they named his vehicle Gary's Gritter.
God, it's going to get worse, isn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, it was just a byproduct.
Yeah.
Mate, you left in 1998.
Yes. Yeah.
And what did you do then?
I went to work for a humanitarian monitoring organisation called the Halo Trust, which had some fame attached to it in 1997 when Princess Diana went out to Angola and she was seen with a big Halo Trust patch on the front of her apron.
The visor,
exactly. So I went to work for Halo and had my interview with them. And even now, there's a lot of ribbing going on saying, oh, that was for officers only. Well, there were 3 of us I can think of off the top of my head who weren't officers working for Halo, and we were all engineers. One was X-59, myself, and another engineer. In fact, there was 4. There's a Welsh guard as well. The rest were officers, to be fair, but went off to work for Halo in Cambodia initially for 3 months, and then on promotion went to Angola, which
was... Can we talk about Cambodia just a sec?
Yeah.
Because that's a bit of history that not many people know about, and it was...
Yeah, and all that
devastating, Pol Pot, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. We were working up on the northwest border with Thailand, something called the K5 mine belt, which pretty much stretches the entire length of Cambodia and Thailand together. And it's about, in places, a kilometre deep. So in widthways, it's a kilometre wide. In some areas, it gets a bit narrower. But we were working up there, and it was great fun. We used to work 21 days straight, then take a day to drive back to Siem Reap, 5 days off, writing reports and having a few beers and decent food, a day drive back, and then 21 days back into the cycle again. Night times, movement was not allowed because of the threat from the Khmer Rouge. They were still operating.
Oh, they were still...
They were still there, yeah. But one location, which I believe was called Cadet de Mor, I could be wrong, but Cadet de Mor, we started doing mine clearance there in the middle of a minefield. And after a period of time, we had such a big enough space to create a permanent camp there made out of wood and local materials.
For you?
For Halo Trust, yeah. And that was for the D-miners rather than the internationals, because there wasn't enough security there for us to be there as well. It was too close to the top.
What's your role then?
We were called at the time, most of the expats were then called other location managers, program managers, ops officers.
So you're not brought in minefields?
You were on trial for 6 months. You were on trial with Halo. So for the first 3 months, although we were out there, we weren't doing the 8 hours on our knees doing the prodding. We were learning about the EOD in that part of the world, so the explosive ordnance in Cambodia and how it differs to what we'd have seen. Russian munitions, for example, is what you're trained in at the time with British Army.
Yeah.
The Cambodians had all sorts, Chinese, Russian.
Wooden
stuff as well, yeah, all sorts of stuff. So we were doing local EOD training. We did some, I remember doing my hands and knees, prodding and searching. And I did that throughout my career with Halo, and that's because I wanted to demonstrate to my local teams that when I give them a bollocking for doing something wrong, I'm talking because I know what I'm talking about, because I've been there on my hands and knees and found mines myself. Yeah. So although I wouldn't be doing it daily, I would get my hand in once a month or so and just make sure people knew exactly that, you know, the boss is on the ground doing his job. But we were there to do capacity development. We weren't there to take jobs away from them. We're there to give them jobs, to recruit, to train, and bring them up to a standard. Liaison between the embassies where the donor money is coming from, bring them out to the site, get them to see the sites, the minefields. And Cambodia in those days was quite a sexy place. It's a phenomenal country to be in, lots of history and a great place. So getting people out to the countryside wasn't difficult, you know, so the donors.
Was it just, you might, excuse my ignorance, was that part of the world affected by the Vietnam War? I know there's quite a difference, but I know Thailand was heavily affected.
It would have been, was it affected or not? I suspect it probably would have been more towards the northeast and the eastern side. And certainly to the north, Lao was severely affected, the Ho Chi Minh Trail. But I suspect this was more internal. But don't quote me, because I should know my history on
that. Yeah, but it was a messed up place, and I'm sure there was a lot of movement of munitions and whatnot around.
Yeah. It was, I mean, the Khmer Rouge, basically it's communist movement, and I could be wrong again, but I'm pretty sure the Khmer Rouge is a communist movement, which would have been aligned with what was going on with the communists entering into Vietnam.
You came out of that part of the world, went down to Africa, flew into Namibia, crossed into Angola.
Yeah.
And what state of play was Angola at this time?
So Angola, this was... Christmas 1998. It was a country in civil war, which had been at the civil war for about 20 odd years by that stage. Well, I was working in a place called Wambo. Still for Halo, yeah. It's the second biggest city in the country, Wambo. And it was hard, it was fought over quite harshly by both UNITA, which was the anti-government troops, and the MPLA, the government troops. We'd already lost a location to UNITA because they were on the wrong side of the wire, and so basically Halo Trust is very neutral, and if we can, we'll employ from both sides of the wire. It doesn't matter to us. We want to make sure there's neutrality across the board. Okay. You can't clear mines on one side and not the other, because it gives one side the other advantage. So in Angola's terms, we had a team working in a place called Bailundu. They'd already gone offline by the time I got there, so we don't know what happened to the local staff, but we do know that the vehicles, the radios would all have been taken and used as part of the war.
Is it a civil war?
Yeah. Yeah, heavy civil war. In effect, my view, and this might be in books somewhere, but my view was the Cold War was being fought in Angola. You had pretty much UNITA saying they were democratic, so supported by the West, and you had the MPLA supported by the Soviet Union.
Oh, okay, there's a bit of an arm wrestle going on.
Basically, yeah. So whatever weapons they could get hold of, they would. They probably had stuff that we don't know that exists, because it was sort of sent out there for trial.
Really?
Potentially.
Yeah, but...
by the Mark VII mine, the anti-tank mine, which Britain, as combat engineers, we were trained how to arm and disarm. They were in the ground in Angola. The Jane's manual pretty much showed every single anti-tank mine and anti-personnel mine in the world in Angola. So Jane's was that thick, you know, about an inch thick of information. It's all in Angola.
Yeah.
So it was a time of civil war, not pleasant. We had guys arrested for allegedly spying. We had vehicles taken off us for no reason. Yet we carried on demining with next to no money. Our funding was coming from core funds. We had no outside funding, really. So guys are wearing rags to work because we didn't have enough money to buy uniforms, but we carried on maintaining the tempo.
Yeah.
Including going back to the same minefield Princess Diana was seen in. We were still clearing that minefield years later.
Oh, that long?
That long, yeah. I believe that one probably took about 3 or 4 years. That was a particularly hard minefield, to be fair. So, not easy.
Mines is such a... Like I've said it three times or something now. They're so horrendous because they don't discriminate.
No.
They'll just do anybody, and that can quite often lead to things like, you know, children being affected, especially when mines are migrating as well. Where if there's like a flood on and the mines lift and move into a safe area, and are you seeing that kind of stuff in the places you've been, like the Cambodia and Angola? Are you seeing that children being affected and really vulnerable people being affected by
it? Across the board. So might jump forward to the second time in Angola.
Yeah, go ahead.
But I went back to Angola the second time, which was after the civil war in 2002. Again, back to Wambo and working in BA province, which is the Netra province across to the east of Wambo. I was asked to go down to do a recce down in Kwando Kabango province for Madison Sans Frontier. They said, we've got a mines problem here. I turned up, and within that week, there was 3 anti-personnel mine accidents. One woman came out of a grass hut, turned left. So we're talking 1 metre outside her house, and bang, she lost her foot.
Which she'd have walked in numerous times before, countless times before.
Pretty much, yeah. The floods would have definitely had a state to play this, because it's very sandy ground. That particular village, though, is laid on, it was built on 3 minefields, in effect. A guy in the woods collecting wood to burn for charcoal and fire lost his leg, and he had to pretty much drag himself from the woods back to hospital. And the third one, I don't remember what the incident was, but I should. And this village was 5 proper buildings, yet there are 42,000 people living there in grass huts. So all
how many buildings, sorry?
5. 5 proper buildings, concrete buildings, cement buildings. The governor, MSF France, the hospital, World Food Programme, the governor.
So they're not like mass... Yeah, they're not big blocks of flats or anything
like that?
Not at
all. No, they were talking one story,
yeah,
6 rooms. That's it.
How long were you there for the second time?
In Angola, I think I was about 9 or 10 months there.
But you'd done about 18 months the first time, hadn't you?
First time was 18 months. And
is that straight?
In Halo, I used to work 6 months off, 3 weeks on, 6 months off, 4 weeks on. So you do 6 months work, then you get 3 weeks off.
So you do 6 months in Angola?
Yeah.
Then get 3 weeks off.
3 weeks off at home or wherever you want to go.
Yeah.
Then 6 months work again, and then 4 weeks off. That was a rotation. So when you do that for 5 years, it's... It takes its time.
I thought you were mad about something we're going to come on to at the end.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking,
yeah, it's ingrained.
But it's so important that these areas get like the British expertise, or the specialists that are in there training those local teams and really developing that culture as well, and that awareness of the situation.
Yeah,
because they're not always aware of what's going
not
on around them.
Yeah, not at
all. So is education a big part of that?
Yeah, so one of the pillars of mine clearance is a risk education, mine risk education. It's probably changed its name again since then. It used to be called MRE, mine risk education. And one of the key things there is you go into schools, it doesn't really matter where you go, it could be anywhere, schools, hospitals, whatever, but you go and teach the local community about the risks of mines in their areas.
Yeah.
There's no point in teaching them about missiles if missiles have never been fired, but if they've got anti-personnel mines, you know, in the local woods, then you go and talk to them about the anti-personnel mines. We also tell them about what you're doing about it. And that's any age, from children right through to old people, because they won't necessarily have a knowledge of mines. You know, they could be farmers. Yeah. They know about mines.
Yeah.
So that was a big part to play in all countries is MRE, and it's still going on now, I'm sure, with agencies.
No, I think it is. I've seen some on, or I have all I follow them all on social media, and there's always stuff going on. Quick question: when the mines are getting laid, because they're in such quantity quite often, do they get hand laid or do they get?
It varies. I mean, certainly, you probably remember your time with the engineers. We could lay mines with machines. I think the majority of the ones I came across in my time were hand laid for sure.
Right.
But so numerous numbers of troops digging, hand laying, covering up, leaving.
Yeah.
Certainly Cambodia, that was a case. Angola, that was a case. Another two countries I'll come on to, yeah, for sure.
And I mentioned it a second ago, like mapping would be the... Look, there's no good way of putting mines down, but if you're going to put mines down, you'd think there'd be mapping involved.
Exactly, yeah.
But quite often these places are just...
Cambodia, there was no mapping. There were the Khmer Rouge would turn up to a village, hold people at gunpoint and say, go and lay the mines quickly as you can.
Right.
So it saves them time. There's no troops there. It's a few people.
Angola,
Mozambique, Angola primarily, it would have been the soldiers themselves digging the mines in. The issue with the place we talked about just now, Mavinga in southeast Angola, it was a village built on a minefield which had been laid initially, let's say, by UNITA troops. MPLA overrun it. They lay their mines. They're overrun. The Cubans were there as well, so the Cubans laid their mines.
Who?
Cuba.
Cubans?
Yeah, Cubans were older than Angola, yeah. Believe it or not.
The Cubans were in Angola?
So the South Africans, so were the Brits, but yeah. It's, yeah. So...
the hell?
So this particular village had three...
But because, sorry, mate, because of the communist thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, that's just...
Yeah. So a lot of the Angolans who were pro-communist would have been educated, for example, in Cuba.
Right, okay.
So if you imagine that the front line's moving back and forwards, every time you move your front line, you put a minefield in. When you're pushed back, you put your new minefield in. So suddenly you've got this village stuck in between with three layers of mines, different minefields. Yeah. So it's horrendous, absolutely horrendous for the locals living there. All the roads are mined, the airstrip wasn't. But we found anti-tank missiles in the bush around the airfield. It was a busy place, busy time.
Well, I mean, we skipped in between two Angolas. Mm. I was going to call them tours then, but two, what would you call them? Deployments,
I guess, yeah.
You did Georgia.
And Mozambique.
And Mozambique in between all that. And straight after Angola, that was 2002, the second one.
Mm-hmm.
We're now in 2003. Yeah. August, September time, you deployed to Iraq. We go to Baghdad.
Yeah.
Are you still with Halo Trust then?
No, so I finished with Halo. I resigned having done 5 years because I think I felt I'd done my time. Was I feeling burnt out? Probably. It was more I'd given what I could to the organisation and to the countries they had at the time. At the time, Halo were in about, I think it was about 8 or 9 countries. And so I've been in 4 or 5 of them, I guess. I didn't really like the idea of going to the other ones for no particular reason. I just thought, nah, don't really fancy that. If you look at Halo's portfolio now, they're in all sorts of wonderful places, Colombia being one of them, Sri Lanka being another. Well, who wouldn't want to go there and work? For me at that time, it was a time to leave and no hard feelings. I'd done my time.
Did you get paid well?
I'll be honest with Halo, not at the time, no. It was, you did it because the pay was okay, but it was bloody good fun. It was satisfying, really satisifying.
I was going to say, what was the reason? If his pay was not good, and it was such a long time, it's not like you're doing a bit of CP work in Afghan for a bit of cash and pay your mortgage off.
Yeah.
Was there a real purpose behind why he was doing it?
I loved it, absolutely loved it. We had the Halo 30-year reunion, Christmas just gone, which was really quite emotional, seeing some of the guys from overseas coming back in, guys who we'd helped nurture up the food chain.
Oh, really?
And they're brought in. So it was great.
Locals,
local staff, from all these countries.
Is the business model kind of promote from within, really?
Absolutely, yeah.
Put the team in of specialists, then bring everyone else on,
and
then move out the specialists to another area,
exactly,
like an asset.
Yeah, and it takes time to do that, you know, because we've been in Afghanistan, Halo's been in Afghanistan, so to say, since the late 80s, I believe. And Afghanistan is now purely run by Afghans with, I think, an expat doing liaison between the UK and Afghanistan. Mm. The idea is you go into a country which is in war or post-war, you create the conditions for the capacity to be developed, and then you put yourself out of a job because you're bringing on these guys so high that you can walk away and say, over to you now. we're done. Yeah.
And you put all like the standard operating procedures in, everything yep. in place.
Yeah.
Do they still run out and get paid from Halo?
Yes, through the donors. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. So internally, stuff you're getting paid, donors there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Right. Okay. I think I'm with you. So 2003. Why are you there? Because this place is overrun with Brits and Americans
in Baghdad.
Yeah.
That's
a perception. So
it was. I basically, when you finish with Halo, I guess with any other organisation like Mines Advisory Group or Norwegian People's Aid, what's next? So you put your CV out, all your friends and contacts, and for me, up on the radar came Armour Group, which is commercial yeah. mine clearance. So that's not humanitarian, we're now talking commercially,
yeah.
which means very specific contracts and a bit more money as well. So Baghdad, we were going to go and do a survey of a power line, 250 kilometres of power line between Baghdad South and Diwanir, to put the power lines back into use post-war. Obviously, they've been smacked during Telic 1. And we found pockets of where ordnance was lying around. We had to go and remove it, destroy it before it got into the wrong hands primarily and before anyone got hurt. Because obviously, those items of ordnance were used against us afterwards as IEDs some years later.
Yeah.
So the idea was to clear up all this mess while it was lying around and anyone could go and pick it up.
Yeah.
So that's what we were there
for. And there was a lot.
There was a lot.
Yeah. It was lying around, and it was near villages, and it was in amongst where people were living throughout the country.
And it was everything. It wasn't just projectiles. There was everything, RPGs, anti-tank mines.
Mate, we were finding stuff like French stuff and all sorts, like big rockets. Like it was all in some British stuff. Oh, not British stuff, but English wording all over everything. But a lot of French.
Yeah, there was, yeah. It just triggered a thought, actually. I remember going up to Taji, which is just north of Baghdad. Taji was an Iraqi army engineer camp with ammunition supply points. Wow, the amount of ordnance that got smacked by the Americans there, who did basically a fast-moving demolition so it couldn't be used. All they did was scatter it to the four winds, so we had to go and clear that mess up as well.
Ah, right.
And that was just phenomenal, the amount of kit that was there. It was years of work. And it wasn't just us, there was other companies in there too, clearing up.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal, yeah.
Was it a good time then to be EOD?
Yes,
in 2003.
Yeah, there's a lot of contracts flying around. I mean, it was mostly Iraq focused, I believe. I'm not sure what else was out there because I was very focused on being somewhere I wanted to be with people I wanted to be with and earning a fairly good wage. And that's
really is that important in this kind of work, to be around people you can trust and organisations that don't cut corners?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I'm trying to think back if we lost anyone or injured anyone due to getting it wrong, and I don't think we did.
I mean, because negligence would be catastrophic in this.
Well, your business would go bust. You wouldn't survive it.
Yeah,
it's critical. Yeah.
The are we training locals in Iraq? Was it just?
We were actually the Iraq Mine Clearance Organization, IMCO, as it was State Department funded through RONCO, and we were there to develop the capacity. So we were training up local teams to be better at what they did. A lot of them were ex-Iraqi army.
Yeah.
Our job there was to bring them up to a standard where we could release them and let them crack on their own.
Yeah.
That didn't happen in my time. I believe it happened sometime after, but we were out near Abu Ghraib prison in the fields outside there near the, what's it called? The agricultural area, the agricultural college actually of Baghdad, clearing up submunitions, which are obviously small bombs, bomblets, very dangerous shaped charges, that sort of stuff.
That had been dropped from
American.
Yeah.
American dropped, yeah.
So expensive, highly efficient.
Yep.
Sometimes they don't go off.
Exactly. In this case, because the ground was so soft, they just sunk into
some of our lads on Telic, they were they found some when they were diving.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And they found some.
Yeah.
I remember he picked one up and he was like going ding ding. He was like, holy shit.
Yeah, they are pretty twitchy.
Yeah. I think they'd done a bridge and then they were building the bridge back, or they were sorting the bridge back out.
Yeah.
And they found them all amongst the remnants of that. You did a bit of work in Sudan.
Yes, South Sudan didn't go so well, so yeah.
Ended up back in Baghdad.
Yes.
And it kind of a little party peace story. You cleared the area that was then built.
That's right, yeah. So went back to Baghdad, back with RONCO again, actually. They got a contract to clear some land in the green zone, which is now called the international zone, I suppose. What we didn't at the time is what it's going to be used for. And having been back there recently, last year, I now realise it was going to be the American Embassy. So what is now the American Embassy in Baghdad, we cleared that land, myself and a couple of others, and obviously some local teams. So that's what we did in whenever it was, 2004 or 5, I think it was 5, 2005.
And then, because you love a bit of adventure, that's what I'm getting. Jeez. Talk about the 2005, let's get onto some of the endurance stuff now. Entered a ski race.
Yeah, so...
Because if all this isn't enough,
yeah,
let's get a ski race in.
Let's get it in.
Yeah.
So there's a mate of mine, actually, who set up a company where they specialise in doing challenges. And he was an X5'9 guy. And when I heard about it, I said, right, you know, let's get a team together. So I got a team, an ex-Royal Marine PTI, who was still serving at the time, actually, and a guy called Steve Cluley, who was he was a sergeant major at 4'9 for a while. I can't remember where he ended up as an RSM. But he was... he was sergeant major at the time of 4'9, so the three of us got on skis and raced against 15 other teams from a place called Resolute Bay in northern Canada, which is, I think, the furthest village north inside the Arctic Circle, up to, we say the North Pole, it sounds very glamorous, it's actually the 1996 recorded position of the magnetic North Pole, which is quite some away, quite some distance from the geographic North Pole. Okay. But still 350 miles, I think.
Yeah.
We were confident, not cocky, we were confident we could win this race. With our Arctic experience of being commando soldiers operating the field in the Arctic was our bread and butter. We looked at the charts and we thought, we could take a shortcut here. And when we arrived at that point, what we saw was a lot of re-entrance. So lots of valleys and hills intermingled, which slowed us down. We were in first place, we went down to fourth place, up to third, up to second, up to first, second, and finished in second place. About 10 days later, and the team that beat us by 3 hours, which is around three miles, and the team that came in third were 2 days behind us.
Wow.
So it really was a fight for the finish between the two teams.
Who was the winning team?
They're all civilians apart from us.
Where from?
Well, bizarrely from where I live, Gloucestershire.
Was they?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say something really, they were from Alaska.
No.
Can we just edit this out? What team, where were they from? Yeah, they're from Alaska.
No, it was quite amusing, actually. And funny enough, there was a team I'd met who were on that, who I'd met in Khartoum. They were British Embassy staff. And there they were racing in the year later in the North Pole race.
Oh, brilliant. So, I mean, that was your real first taste of that kind of civilian endurance racing. Yeah. And we'll get on to some other bits and pieces in a second. But you then went on and did a bit of close protection work for the British consulate, Embassy in Basra Palace. You then, because you're a civilian at this point, you then rejoin as a reserve officer with the Royal Engineers.
Yeah, well, I joined as a sapper, but then I said to my OC, I'm sorry, but I'm too old to start sweeping gyms. He said, so I joined as a sapper because I'd been out too long to get your rank back. Got Lance Corporal, I think, about 3 months later. And I still said to the boss then, I'm sorry, but I'm too old and too long in the tooth and seen too much to be sweeping the gym.
You're 35 at this point then?
Yeah, 35.
Yeah.
And he goes, right, why don't you give a commissioning a crack? So I gave it a crack and actually it's quite enjoyable.
Why did you rejoin?
It was primarily focused on being part of the team. So I'd chosen three other guys to join me to row across the Atlantic and they were still serving. Again, commando sappers. And I thought, well, they said to me, look, if you join up, then... there are advantages to this financially, being in the military. And I was like, okay, great. So I did, joined up, and I thought I'd only do it for a short stint, but actually I'm still serving as a reservist now.
Yeah, I mean, you've been out for a while, haven't you?
7 years, yeah. Yeah, 1998 to 2005.
Yeah. So the Royal the Atlantic then, so it's 4 years.
Yeah, we set off, so basically four teams set off from New York in a race to cross the North Atlantic to Cornwall. The aim was to finish in Falmouth. I think it was about day two, we heard that one of the boats was going to turn back because they were taking on a lot of water. Basically, day two was a force line gale. We were really in a nasty weather pattern, not pleasant at all. I remember one stage, all four of us were in the rear cabin, which is getting a bit cosy and comfy, but the boat didn't capsize. She did really well, so we cracked on and... SATCOMs broke after four weeks, so we just focused on VHF line of sight comms and carried on rowing. We didn't even know who won the Football World Cup at the stage, that sort of stuff, because we didn't have any news at all.
When was that, 2006?
Yeah. So we carried on rowing, and 85 days later, we rowed into Mevagissey around the corner from Falmouth because the weather was so bad. We had a force.
Oh, so you came into the UK?
Yeah. We were rowing home, basically.
Was it nice then to get in?
It was fantastic to see so many people waiting for us on the quayside. The annoying thing was as we were just about to start our approach into Mevagissi, basically the wind picked up and pushed us offshore. And I've got a photo of Ben and myself rowing, and the oars are bending so much they're about to break. And we had to take a tow for 1 mile to bring us back into the lee, into the shelter of the cliffs. So we'd rowed 3,317 miles, but couldn't make that 1 mile. And then we did actually go back to the oars to finish off to come into the harbour. But that cost us a few world records, because we earned 2 Guinness World Records on that alone.
What did you earn?
The longest distance rowed across the North Atlantic, land to land, was 3,370 miles. Another one I hopefully has been broken now. It's the oldest crew ever to row an ocean.
Really?
Yeah, cumulative age of 155 years. And we raised $250,000 for charity, so it's well worth it.
Oh, really? $250,000?
Yeah. Yeah.
What charity did you raise for?
Meningitis, because one of the teammates, his son, had died at the age of 16 from meningitis very suddenly. So it's well worth doing for that.
The team element, because there's obviously that, again, that purpose to get across. But I kind of, if you could summarise, what was it like then to be part of that club? Really, really quite confined for such a long...
It was difficult, to be honest with you. The team I asked, two of them were... one of them was my sergeant major, and one of them was best buddies, and we all played rugby together. So they were the two props. The other guy I asked was one of the flankers, and so we're the similar size. The other two guys were similar size. So in effect, we broke down into two teams. That inadvertently caused problems because we split into two teams. We've got four alpha males splitting into two alpha teams, basically. The accusations going backs and forwards, the arguments. It was okay, but we learned a lot about ourselves, I think. And we don't actually, not that we're enemies now, but we don't pick up the phone to each other. We don't call each other. But we didn't do that beforehand anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So
okay.
The status quo hasn't really changed.
Yeah. You would have thought, you know, from the outside looking in, you'd have thought you'd have been so tight.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it almost just showed the human element of...
Yeah.
Of,
I don't know what the other three guys think, but I suspect they were glad to get off the boat and never look back, really. Certainly Ben said he'd never row an ocean ever again, and that was him done.
I mean, great achievement, because we're going to miss a few things out here, and you know, we go from four in a boat, 85 days. I'm just going to skim over a few things. You then started working for HESCO, who support us with this podcast. You did a bit of Afghan stuff. Well, a bit of Afghan. You spent 18 months in Afghan doing what you do best, clearing mines. You did a degree. You worked for the UN in Nepal, doing again what you do best. Did a bit of work in Basra with Mine Action, and then you went from four in a boat to one in a boat, and you attempted to cross the Pacific.
Yeah, that was 2012. So it was May the 5th, 2012. A push back from Choshi in Japan, which is a fishing village to the east of the country, and set off across the Pacific in my solo ocean rowing boat called Blossom. We had a perfect conditions to leave. We had a wind pushing us offshore. We had a sky was just blue. We saw whales in the distance. I say we because I refer to the boat and myself as a team. And so, and we got about, I think we were about 30 miles offshore that day, and did really well. I was really happy, and got into a current which would push us even further offshore. Long and short it was, saw dolphins every few days, saw some ships, saw flying fish, and then 4 weeks later or so, I was given the nod that there was some heavy weather coming my way. And it wasn't just heavy weather, it was a typhoon. And so I thought, right, okay, I need to continue rowing for as much as possible, then batten down the hatches, literally get everything inside, batten down and hold on tight. And then 5 days later, Blossom started capsizing, and she's designed to capsize sideways. There's no problem with that at all, and I'd practiced that just off Tynmouth and Devon with the RNLI. But capsize number 7 was a pitch pole, which is the back end being lifted over the front end. She's 21 foot long, 6 foot wide. So and I'm at the stern end, so my backside and my head are right in the end of the boat, and then we're getting lifted up over the bow. So at least 21 foot in the air, slap bang on the water. It bows the cabin wall inwards, which cracks. And then we roll over back up the right way. But we get wrapped around the parachute anchor, which rips off the rudder, rips off the spare oars, and rips off the antennas, and leaves me a crack down the bulkhead. Yeah. So the first instinct, so I guess this is probably a SAP initiative, is can I fix it? It's like, no. So then I put a pan call out, which is on VHF to call any shipping.
It's scary.
Oh, yeah. I was very, very scared at the time. There's even a video on YouTube, I think, of me, an old man. a man of his 40s crying his eyes out. This isn't fun.
Yeah. I'll put that on the show notes.
Yeah.
And that's going out on social media.
Oh, great.
mate,
it was Discovery Channel anyway, so it was all is across Discovery Channel. But yeah, so it all went wrong. I say all went wrong. Actually, everything went well. The boat was designed to do exactly what she was supposed to do, and she wasn't designed to pitch pole capsize.
Yeah.
She was designed to do everything else. Everything that went out there, every process we had for the recovery, which I'd say recovery, not rescue, all worked. The information plan of who we tell, how we tell them, how we release information, all that sort of stuff, everything worked to treat. So a lot of lessons learnt, and that's the reason why things went so well, I think. We did a lot of planning.
Yeah. And no plan goes according to plan.
Exactly. No plan survives contact, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, let's move us a bit, mate, because this next... So you're going back.
Yeah.
2019, Royal Pacific.
Yeah.
You're part of Team HESCO.
Yeah.
You are a bit bonkers.
I've been called worse.
Because, you know, all these... You know, we haven't mentioned family up until this point, but now you've got a couple of kids and whatnot. Yeah. And
single in 2012, now married with two kids and a dog.
Yeah.
Yeah. HESCO have been great. They sponsored us in 2006 to row the Atlantic. And they're now sponsoring me to row the Pacific next year. Mm. So Blossom, as she still is, she's been repaired. As you say, under the banner of Team HESCO, Row Pacific 29 kicks off in April next year. The boat's been prepared and built. Sorry, prepared. She's been repaired and prepared.
Yeah.
And systems are in place again, ready for getting back on the water in the UK this year and to start rowing again next year.
Who are you raising money for?
There's three charities and a foundation this time. The first one is a charity called Give Them a Sporting Chance, which I'm the chairman of, where we help disabled people and or their carers to do something they wouldn't normally do. Carers obviously get forgotten about quite a lot sometimes. And that could be anything. They tell us what they want to do and we'll see if we can make it happen. Mm. We're very lucky that we've got Her Royal Highness the Princess Royal as our guardian, so we meet her twice a year on average to discuss what we want to do for the last 6 months, what we want to do for the next 6 months. The second charity is Veterans in Action, which was created by a sapper, Billy McLeod, and focuses on post-traumatic stress disorder for veterans. And I'm very keen that we do a lot more on mental health in veterans. That's just one of my things. So that's the second charity. Third charity is another sort of PTSD-orientated charity called the VC Gallery, based down in Haverford West in West Wales, set up by a guy called Barry John, 24 years in the forces. And he has a passion for art. And one of the problems you have with veterans is they don't communicate when they've got a problem. They tend to bottle things up. But if you tell someone to draw a picture, they'll draw it, and then you can ask them to explain it, and then suddenly they open up. So that's the three charities, and then the fourth one is the Allied Forces Foundation, which is a transatlantic foundation set up by an ex-sapper, Stu Taylor. So to help Americans and Brits and their founders to do things they wouldn't normally do. So that's the four.
Brilliant, mate. How can people follow you on Twitter?
Charlie Martel 1.
Yeah. And you can go through ours at D-Class Podcast and you'll get to you. I think this conversation has been so important, and it's to highlight that just the amount of ordnance and mines and explosives out there in all these different countries. And I purposely wanted to visit those countries today and not focus on one specific area, just because it is a horrendous kind of virus, really. That's
perfect soldier.
Always there, never sleeps, and it'll bite you if you come into contact with it. But mate, look, you're absolutely inspirational, and you've dedicated a big chunk of your life to helping other people. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I really do wish you all the best going forward. Do you have anything else to kind of add?
No, it's been great to meet you, and obviously where we met recently at 100 Days to Peace was phenomenal. Tomorrow's the launch of Row Pacific 2019, and again Princess Anne will be there to launch the challenge.
Well, actually, that's a couple of weeks gone past now, but it's all going full steam ahead, and I think we will leave it there.